This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Autobiography by Christina Lauren, read by Deacon Lee and Kyle Mason. For Maddie, because this book would not be here without you. And for every teen who has ever needed to hear it, you are perfect exactly the way you are. And love is 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 love cannot be killed or swept aside. Lin-Manuel Miranda. Chapter 1. The end of our final winter break seems almost like the beginning of a victory lap. We're 7 semesters into our high school career with one last token, honestly, semester to go. I want to celebrate like your average guy, with some private time and a few mindless hours down the YouTube rabbit hole. Unfortunately, neither of those things is going to happen. Because across from her bed, Autumn is glaring at me, waiting for me to explain myself. My schedule isn't complete, and classes start up in 2 days, and the good ones fill up fast, and this is just so like you, Tanner. It's not that she's wrong, it is just like me. But I can't help it if she's the ant and I'm the grasshopper in this relationship. That's the way it's always been. Everything's fine. Everything's fine, she repeats, tossing her pencil down. You should have that printed on the t-shirt. Autumn is my rock, my safe place. The best of my best. But when it comes to school, she is unbelievably anal retentive. I roll onto my back, staring up at her ceiling from the bed. For her birthday sophomore year, right after I moved here and she took me under her wing, I gave her a poster of a kitten diving into a tub of fuzzy balls. To this day, the poster remains sturdily taped there. It's a super cute cat, but by junior year, I think the innocent sweetness of it had slowly sullied its inherent weirdness. So over the motivational phrase, dive right in, kitty, I taped 4 post-it notes with what I think the creator of the poster might have intended to say. Don't be a pussy. She must agree with the edit, because she's left it up there. I turn my head to gaze over at her. Why are you so worried? It's my schedule. I'm not worried, she says, crunching down a stack of crackers. But you know how fast things fill up. I don't want you to end up with Hoy for Ochem because he gives twice as much homework, and that'll cut into my social life. This is a half-truth. Getting Hoy for Chem would cut into her social life. I'm the one with the car. I chauffeur her around most of the time. But what Autumn really hates is that I leave things to the last minute and then manage to get what I want anyway. We're both good students in our own way. We're both high honor roll, and we both killed our ACTs. But where Autumn with homework is a dog with a bone, I'm more like a cat lying in a sunny window. If the homework is within reach and doing something interesting, I'll happily charm it. Well, your social life is our priority. I shift my weight, brushing away a trail of cracker crumbs stuck to my forearm. They've left a mark there, tiny red indentations in the skin, the same way gravel might. She could stand to spread some of her obsessiveness to room cleaning. Autumn, my God, you're a pig. Look at this bed. She responds to this by shoving another stack of Ritz in her mouth, crumbling another trail onto her Wonder Woman sheets. Her reddish hair is a messy pile on her head, and she's wearing the same Scooby-Doo pajamas she's had since she was 14. They still fit, mostly. If you ever get Eric in here, I say, he'll be horrified. Eric is another one of our friends, and only one of a handful of non-Mormon kids in our grade. I guess technically Eric is Mormon, or at least his parents are. They're what most people would call Jack Mormon. They drink, both alcohol and caffeine, but are still reasonably involved in the church. Best of both worlds, he says, although it's easy to see that the other Latter-day Saint students at Provo High don't agree. When it comes to social circles, Jack Mormon is the same as not Mormon at all, like me. A few dry flecks of cracker fly out when Autumn coughs at this, feigning repulsion. I don't want Eric anywhere near my bed. And yet here I am, lying on her bed. It's a testament to how much her mother trusts me that I'm allowed in her room at all. But maybe Mrs. Green senses already that nothing will happen in here between me and Audie. We did that once, over winter break our sophomore year. I'd lived in Provo for only 5 months by that point, but there was an immediate chemistry between us. driven by a lot of classes in common and a comfort from our shared defector status with the Mormon kids at school. Unfortunately, the chemistry dissolved for me when things got physical, and by some miracle, we dodged the post-makeout awkward bullet. I'm not willing to risk it again. She seems to grow hyper-aware of our proximity at the same moment I do, straightening and pulling her pajamas down her torso. I push up so I'm sitting, leaning against the headboard, a safer position. Who do you have for first? Autumn looks down at her schedule. Polo, modern lit? Same. I steal a cracker, and, like a civilized human, manage to eat it without dropping a crumb. Scanning down my paper with an index finger, I feel pretty good about this last term. Honestly, my schedule isn't too bad. I only need to add something for fourth.
Maybe you can add the seminar,
Autumn claps joyfully. Her eyes are flashlights beaming their thrill into the dusky room. She has wanted to take this course since she was a freshman. The seminar. I'm serious. When the school refers to it in newsletters or announcements, they even capitalize it like that. It's so pretentious, it's unreal. Write a book in a semester, the catalog cheerfully dares, as if that could happen only in this class. As if the average person couldn't throw together enough words in 4 months. 4 months is a lifetime. Students who apply need to have completed at least one advanced placement English course and have a minimum of a 3.75 GPA for the previous term. Even if that includes 70 kids in our grade alone, the teacher only enrolls 14. 2 years ago, the New York Times wrote an article and called it a brilliantly ambitious course, earnestly and diligently directed by the New York Times best-selling faculty member, Tim Fujita. I know that direct quote because the piece was printed out, enlarged to about 5,000 times the original size, and framed in the front office. My frequent gripe is the criminal overuse of adverbs, which Autumn thinks makes me petty. Last year, a senior named Sebastian Brother took the seminar, and some big publisher bought his manuscript. I don't even know who he is, and I've heard his story 100 times. He's the bishop's son. He wrote a high fantasy novel. Apparently it was amazing. Mr. Fujita sent it to an agent who sent it to people in New York, and there was some sort of civilized warfare for it, and boom, now he's across the street at BYU and apparently delaying his mission so that he can do a book tour and become the next Tolkien. Or L. Ron Hubbard. Though I guess some Mormons might take issue with that comparison. They don't like to be lumped in with cults like Scientology. Then again, neither do Scientologists. Anyway, now, other than BYU football and the Sea of Mormons, the seminar is the only thing anyone ever talks about anymore when they mention Provo. You got in? I confirm, not that I'm surprised. This class means everything to Autumn, and apart from already meeting the actual requirements, she's been devouring novels nonstop in the hope that she'll get a chance to write her own. She nods. Her smile stretches from sea to shining sea.
Badass.
You could, too, if you talk to Mr. Fujita, she says. You have the grades. You're a good writer. Plus, he loves your parents.
Nah.
I'm expecting acceptance letters to colleges anywhere but here. Mom begged me to only apply out of state, and a yes from any of those schools will be conditional on my grades this last semester. Regardless of how easy I think this might be, this is not the time to be taking chances. Autumn picks at a beleaguered fingernail. Because then you'd have to, you know, finish something. I finished your mom earlier. I think you know what I mean. She pulls my leg hair and I screech a surprisingly feminine sound.
Tanner, she says, sitting up. I'm serious. It would be good for you. You should take this class with me.
You say that like I would want to. Glaring at me, she growls.
It's the seminar, asshole. Everyone wants to.
See what I mean? She's got this course on a pedestal, and it's so nerdy it makes me a little protective of future Autumn when she's out in the world battling her Hermione nerd girl battles. I give her my best smile.
Okay.
Are you worried about coming up with something original? She asks. I could help you.
Come on. I moved here when I was 15, which I think we can agree is the worst time to move from Palo Alto, California, to Provo, Utah, with a mouthful of metal and no friends. I have stories.
Not to mention I'm a half-Jewish queer kid in a straight and Mormon town. I don't say that last part, not even to Autumn. It wasn't that big a deal in Palo Alto when, at 13, I realized I liked the idea of kissing guys as much as kissing girls. Here, it would be a huge deal. She's the best of my best, yeah,
but I don't want to risk telling her and finding out she's only progressive in theory and not when a queer kid is hanging out in her bedroom. We all had braces, and you had me. She flops back on her bed. Besides, everyone hates being 15, Tanner. It's period emergencies and boners at the pool, zits and angst and unclear social protocol. I guarantee 10 out of 15 students in this class will write about the perils of high school for lack of deeper sources of fiction. A quick scan through the Rolodex of my past gives me a lurching, defensive feeling right in my gut, like maybe she's right. Maybe I couldn't come up with something interesting and deep, and fiction must come from depth. I've got two supportive, maybe overly supportive parents, a crazy but wonderful extended family, a not too terrible, although dramatically emo sister, my own car. I haven't known a lot of turmoil. So I balk, pinching the back of her thigh. What makes you so deep? It's a joke, of course. Autumn has plenty to write about. Her dad died in Afghanistan when she was 9. Afterward, her mom, angry and heartbroken, cut ties with the Mormon Church, which in this town is a huge defection. More than 90% of the people who live here are LDS. Being anything else automatically leaves you on the outskirts of the social world. Add into the mix that on Mrs. Green's salary alone, she and Autumn barely scrape by. Autumn looks up at me flatly. I can see why you wouldn't want to do it, Tan. It's a lot of work, and you're lazy. She baited me into adding the stupid class, and now, as we drive to school together the Monday after winter break, she's being brittle and clipped because I told her I got in. I can feel her heated glare on the side of my face as I turn onto Bulldog Boulevard. Fujita just signed your ad card, she says. That's it? Audie, you're insane if you're pissed about this. You get that, right? And what? She says, ignoring my rhetorical and turning the face forward. You're going to do it? Yeah, why not? I pull into the student lot, scanning for a spot close to the door, but of course we're running late and there's nothing convenient here. I slip into a spot along the back of the building. Tanner, do you realize what it is? How could I attend this school and not know what the seminar is? She gives me an aggressively patient look because I've just used my mocking voice and she hates it. You're going to have to write a book, an entire book. When the end of my fuse appears, it is predictably mild, a rougher-than-normal shove of my door open into the frigid air. Audie, what the hell? I thought you told me to add it. Yeah, but you shouldn't do it if you don't want to. I pull out my best smile again, the one I know she likes. I know I shouldn't, but hey, you use the tools you have. Then you shouldn't call me lazy. She lets out this savage growl I think I like. You're so lucky and you don't even know it. I ignore her, grabbing my backpack from the trunk. She's confusing as hell. Do you see what I mean, though, that it was easy for you? She jogs after me. I had to apply an interview with him and, like, grovel. You walked into his office and he signed your ad slip. It wasn't exactly like that. I went to his office, chatted him up for a bit, updated him on my folks, and then he signed my ad slip. I'm met with silence, and when I turn, I realize she's walked in the other direction, toward the side entrance. I'll see you at lunch, best friend, I call out. She raises her middle finger. The warmth inside the hall is heaven, but it's loud in here, and the floors are soggy with dirty melting snow knocked off boots. I squeak down the hall to my locker, sandwiched between Sasha Sanderson and Jack Thorne, two of the best-looking and nicest people at Provo High. Socially, things here are mixed. Even 2.5 years later, I still feel like the new kid, and it's probably because most of the students here have gone to school together since kindergarten and live within a handful of wards, meaning they're in the same congregation and see each other for about 1 million church activities outside of school. I essentially have Audie, Eric, and a few other friends who happen to be LDS but cool, so they don't drive us too crazy, and their parents don't worry we're corrupting them. Back in Palo Alto, my freshman year, I was sort of dating another guy for a few months, and had a whole group of friends I'd known since kindergarten who didn't blink when they saw me holding Gabe's hand. I wish I'd appreciated that freedom more at the time. Here, girls flirt with me, sure, but most of them are Mormon and would never, not in 1 million years, be allowed to date me. Most LDS parents hope their children will marry in their temple, and that just can't happen with someone like me, a non-member. Unless I converted, which is never going to happen. Take Sasha, for example.
I feel something brewing between us. She's super flirty and touchy, but Autumn insists it could never go anywhere. To an even greater extent, the same is true of my chances here with guys, LDS or otherwise. I don't get to test those waters in Provo. I've had a crush on Jack Thorne since 10th grade, but he's off limits for 3 important reasons. 1, male. 2, Mormon. 3, Provo. Before she got pissed at me this morning, Audie handed me, without comment, a sheet of sparkly dinosaur stickers. So without question, I pocketed them. Autumn is known to hand me things that will be of use at some unknown point in time, and I roll with it. As I open my locker, I realize her motive. I am notoriously bad about remembering my A and B day schedule. We practice an alternating day class schedule here, with periods 1 through 4 on some days, and periods 5 through 8 on others. Each term, I need to tape my schedule to my locker, and each term, I find myself without any tape. "You're brilliant," Sasha says, coming up behind me to better see what I'm doing. "And oh my god, you're so cute. Dinosaurs. Tanner, are you 8? I got them from Autumn. I hear Sasha's reaction to this in her silence, the unspoken, "Are they or aren't they?" Everyone wonders whether Autumn and I are casually banging. As ever, I leave it unanswered. Her suspicion is a good thing. Unwittingly, Autumn has been my shield. "Nice boots," I tell her. They reach a suggestive height, just past her knees. I wonder whose attention she's aiming for the most here, the guys at school or her parents at home. I give her a dinosaur sticker and a kiss on the cheek as I slip past her down the hall with my books. Provo High is not by any means a religious school, but sometimes it feels that way. And if there's one thing you learn quickly about Mormons, it's that they focus on the positive. Positive feelings, positive actions, happy, happy, joy, joy. So Modern Lit with Mrs. Polo starts out with an unexpected and decidedly unhappy bang. The first book we're reading is The Bell Jar. I feel a faint murmur around the room as students shift in their seats to make surreptitious eye contact in such dramatic unison that their covert efforts are wasted. Mrs. Polo, wild hair, flowy skirts, rings on thumbs, you know the deal, ignores the commotion. In fact, I think she's sort of enjoying it. She rocks back on her heels, waiting for us to return to the syllabus and see what else she has in store for us. Barbara Kingsolver's The Poisonwood Bible, Elie Wiesel's Night, Milan Kundera's The Unbearable Lightness of Being, Jeanette Walls's The Glass Castle, and so on, into Toni Morrison's Sula, and even James Goddamn Frey's fake memoir. Perhaps most shocking is Sinclair Lewis's Elmer Gantry, a novel dealing with fanatical religion and a tent revival-style creepy preacher. It's pretty on the nose. Mrs. Polo is ballsy, and I for one like seeing their cages rattled. At my side, and still giving me the silent treatment, Autumn is sitting up, eyes wide. She's read almost every book on this list, and if I know her, I know what she's thinking. Is there time to transfer to Shakespeare with Mr. Geyser? She turns and looks at me, her eyes narrowing as she reads my mind right back. She growls again, and I can't help the laugh it pulls from me. "I've read almost all these books, too," Autumn insisted. I lean back, lacing my fingers behind my head and giving her another good smile. Piece of cake. I have an easy semester ahead. Chapter 2. By the time fourth period rolls around, Autumn is buzzing with nerves. She's excited for the seminar, but still irritated that I wormed my way into it. I trail just behind her down the hall and try not to let her see me smile when she purposely evades me inside the door, moving toward a group of desks where only one seat remains free. "Over here, Audie." Standing in the back row, I hold out an empty chair for her beside the one I plan to claim. She has the option to come join me or look mysteriously petulant, so she shuffles over, glowering. "You're a pest." "I love you, but only a little." She laughs. "Don't ruin this for me." And there, right there, it is. I could ruin this by being a total jackass about something she's put her whole heart into. She thinks I'd want to? The way I'm acting, she probably does. "I won't." I slide my good luck eraser onto her desk, the one she gave me for Christmas 2 years ago, with the old school He-Man illustration printed into the rubber. What used to be a white square is now a gray nub. Present-day eraser He-Man barely has a face and only one leg. Her freckled nose wrinkles as she scowls at me without much commitment. I am forgiven. Mr. Fujita walks in, arms filling with a teetering stack of books. He slides them gracelessly onto his desk in the center of the semicircle of work tables and ignores them when they slide into a messy pile. A copy of Stephen King's The Stand slaps harshly to the floor, landing face down and open. He ignores it. In my peripheral vision, I could see Autumn sit up straighter, and I know she is now intensely worried about the pages of the enormous book growing crumpled under its own weight the longer it sits there.
"Morning," Mr. Fujita sings, and then looks up behind us at the clock on the wall. "Oops, afternoon. I'm Tim Fujita. Everyone just calls me Fujita."
I've always really liked Fujita, but the way he hands out his own nickname makes me like him about 7% less. We murmur greetings in return, quiet from intimidation or because we're tired after lunch, and he grins at us, taking in our faces one by one. I glance around, too, at the class composition. Josh, Dustin, Amanda, Julie, Clive, Burrito Dave, Sabine, Soccer Dave, Asher, Kylie, McKenna, James, Levi. Every single one of them is Mormon. Trimmed hair, modest sleeves, good posture. In the back row, Autumn and I are a pair of gangly trees looming over a lush, manicured lawn. Fujita winks when he sees me. He thinks my mom is a superhero. Beside me, Autumn lets out a measured exhale through her nose. Because of my mom, a computer genius, and my dad, a highly profiled cardiac surgeon who, according to the papers, saved the governor of Utah, I've received special treatment from teachers since the day I moved here. Fujita adding me to seminar is clearly one such perk. "Welcome, guys." He spreads his hands out and takes another sweeping glance around the room. "Where is he?" At our puzzled silence, Fujita scans the room again and then looks at us for answers. "Who?" Dustin, seated, as ever, right up in front, finally asks. Fujita glances at his watch as if to confirm that he's in the right place. "I had hoped this would be a cool surprise, and I assume it will be anyway, but I guess he's running late." We reply with anticipatory silence as his eyebrows slowly lift skyward. "We'll have a special aide this term," he tells us. I can imagine the drum roll he's intending, but his dramatic pauses give the moment a bewildering, anticlimactic feel instead. "You'll be thrilled to hear that Sebastian Brother will be mentoring each of you." A chorus of excited noises pours out of the 14 other bodies in the room, a Mormon hero coming to spend time with us. Even Autumn has clapped her hand over her mouth. To her, LDS or not, Sebastian is a local celebrity. With his hands laced together in front of him, Fujita rocks back on his heels. "Seb has a very busy schedule, of course," I mentally groan, "Seb. But he and I both feel that his experience can benefit each of you. I believe he will inspire you. After taking this very course, he is only 19 and on his way to a prestigious literary career." Leaning in, Fujita adds confidentially, "Of course, I've read his novel. It is stunning, stunning." "Has he heard of Christopher Paolini?" I whisper to Autumn. She delivers a shut up by way of an icy glare. Fujita grabs a stack of papers from a torn folder and begins handing them out. "I assume we can skip the why are you here? You're here to write a book, right?" Nearly everyone nods enthusiastically. "And you will. 4 months isn't very long, it's true, but you will get it done. You will figure it out. That's why I'm here. We're going to hit the ground running." He makes his way around the room. "I have a suggested reading list, and I have a variety of resources on how to get started and what types of writing processes are out there, but in truth, the only way to write a book is to write it. However you get it done, that is your process." I look down at the syllabus and proposed drafting schedule he slipped on my desk and feel my forehead heat, feel that prickle pin crawl of panic up my neck. I have this week to come up with an idea. 1 week. When I feel Autumn's attention on me, I turn, giving her an easy smile. But apparently it isn't as easy as I hope. Her own grin falters, cracking at one side. "You can do this," she says quietly, seeing straight through me. "Ask me to differentiate trigonometric functions and I'll nail it. Give me a molecular modeling kit and I'll build you the most beautiful organic compound you've ever seen. But ask me to pull something straight from my gut and share it with the world. Mental mayhem. I don't particularly relish working, but at odds with this is my other hatred of doing a shitty job at anything. I've never tried to be creative before, and realize it only now that I'm sitting here." To make it worse, Fujita adds, Now, experience tells me that most of you already have an idea in mind, but over the next week, Sebastian and I will help you hone it, polish it, and then you dive right in. I can't even enjoy that he's repeated Autumn's inspirational pussy poster slogan verbatim, because for the first time in, well, maybe ever, I feel like I'm in over my head. Autumn slides my He-Man eraser back onto my desk and uses it as an excuse to squeeze my hand. The door slides open, the chairs scrape mildly across hardwood as people turn. We all know who it is, but we look anyway. The one and only time I've ever seen Autumn drunk was this past summer, which is also the one and only time she admitted she was in love with me. I thought we'd been on the same page after our makeout session 2 years ago, but apparently not. Sometime after drinking 4 Mike's Hard Lemonades, but before shaking me awake on her floor and begging me with boozy breath to forget everything she said, she babbled for an hour about the secret feeling she'd been harboring the past couple years. From the haze of my own inebriation and the tangle of her alcohol-fueled incoherence, I remember only 3 clear sentences. Your face makes sense to me. Sometimes I get the weird feeling I wouldn't be enough for you. I love you, but only a little. Being who we are, the only way to move past the potential for profound awkwardness afterward was to joke about it for a solid week. I love you, but only a little, became our new best friend's motto. Autumn tried to explain the logic of my face making sense to her a few times to no real success, something about symmetry of features and how they're pleasing to her on an instinctive level. But it's still one of my favorite non sequiturs. When I see her getting stressed out about anything, I just say, Audie, calm down. Your face makes sense to me. And she breaks. Every time she laughs. The second sentence, sometimes I get the weird feeling I wouldn't be enough for you, hit too close to home. Although I'd been working up the nerve to come out to her, after she said this, I changed my mind. Audie's words twanged that dissonant chord inside me, the inner conflict about what it means to be bisexual. There's the devil on one shoulder, the ignorant perception that I get from all sides, both inside and outside the queer community, who say bisexuality is really about indecision, that it's impossible for bisexuals to be satisfied with one person, and the label is a way to not commit. And then there's the angel on the other shoulder, who the queer positive books and pamphlets encourage me to believe, saying that no, what it means is that I'm open to falling in love with anyone. I'm happy to commit, but the specific parts don't matter as much as the person. But I've never fallen in love, and have never felt that clawing ache for any one person. I never know which of them will end up being right. When Autumn said that about not being enough for me, I let it go and pretended I didn't remember. The problem is, I do remember. In fact, I obsess about it, while pretending I'm not painfully waiting for the moment when someone knocks me over, makes me feel sure about them in a way I've never been sure about anything in my whole life. So when Sebastian brother walks into our class, and he sees me, and I see him, I have the sense of falling sideways out of my chair. I am drunk, and I know now what Autumn meant about faces. I've seen him before, in the halls around school, but I never paid much attention. He's one of the perfect uber LDS kids, the son of a bishop, and as far as I can tell, incredibly devout. But here I can't seem to drag my attention away. Sebastian isn't a kid anymore. I notice his defined jaw and downturned almond eyes, ruddy cheeks, and anxiously shifting Adam's apple as he swallows under the weight of our stares. Hey, guys. He gives a small wave, walking haltingly deeper into the room to shake Fujita's hand. A classroom's worth of eyes track him like crosshairs. Fujita beams at us. What did I tell you? Sebastian's hair is shaved on the side, floppy up top. His smile is so wide and bright and pure. He is fucking beautiful. But there's something beyond it, something in the way he moves that catches my fascination. Maybe it's the way his eyes don't settle on any one person too long. Maybe it's the way I sense he's slightly wary of us. As he faces the class from the front row, his eyes flash when they meet mine. For a tiny flicker of a second, and then again, like a prism catching light because he does a double take. That fraction of a heartbeat is long enough for him to register my immediate infatuation. Holy shit, how quickly he recognizes it. This must happen to him all the time, an adoring gaze from across the room. But to me, being so instantly infatuated is entirely foreign. Inside my chest, my lungs are wild animals clawing at the cage.
Oh, man, Autumn mumbles from beside me. His smile makes me stupid. Her words are a dim echo of my own thoughts. His smile ruins me. The feeling makes me uneasy, a dramatic lurch that tells me I need to have him or I won't be okay. Beside me, she sighs in disappointment, oblivious to my own internal meltdown. Too bad he's Mormon. Chapter 3. Monday afternoon. We are homework-free, Mom is home early, and she sees it as a sign that she needs to take her children shopping. My sister, Haley, is thrilled at the opportunity to get more funeral wear. I agree to come, albeit unenthusiastically, mostly because I know if I were left to my own devices, I would spend hours on my laptop, with multiple browser tabs open, trying to learn more about Sebastian Brother. Fortunately, Autumn is tagging along. Mom's superpower seems to be her uncanny ability to find the ugliest clothing for her children. In this way, Autumn is a great wing woman. But unfortunately, having all three of them around means any mobile Sebastian investigation needs to be done covertly. Autumn might raise an eyebrow if she caught me Googling pictures of our hot male TA. Mom and Haley know I like guys, but Mom in particular would not be thrilled to know that the object of my current interest is the local bishop's son. Organized religion isn't something that's regarded too fondly in our house. My dad is Jewish, but hasn't been to temple in years. Mom grew up LDS, just north of here in Salt Lake City, but defected from the church at 19 when her younger sister, my Aunt Emily, came out in high school, and her parents and the church cut her off. Of course, I wasn't around then, but I've heard some of the stories, and see Mom's forehead vein make an appearance whenever any aspect of the church's narrow-mindedness comes up. My mom didn't want to break up with her parents, but, like any normal, compassionate human, couldn't justify alienating someone she loved because of a bunch of old rules in a book. So then you might ask, why are we here, living in the most LDS-dense place in the world? Also, ironically, my mother. 2.5 years ago, a massive, super-loaded software company based here lured her away from Google, where she'd been the only senior software engineer with an XX genotype, and she basically cleaned the floor with everyone around her. Next Tech offered her the CEO position, but she asked for the CTO job instead, which came with an almost unlimited tech development budget. Right now, her team is developing some 3D holographic modeling software for NASA. For any other family with 2 six-figure incomes still barely cutting it in the South Bay, the decision would have been an easy one. A salary hike in a place where the cost of living could fit in our smallest Palo Alto closet? Done. But because of Mom's past, the decision to move was agonizing. I still remember hearing my parents arguing about it late into the night while Haley and I were supposed to be sleeping. Dad thought it was an opportunity she couldn't possibly turn down, and one that would feed her imagination. Mom agreed, but worried about how it would affect her children. In particular, she worried about how it would affect me. 2 months before the offer came in, I admitted to my parents that I'm bisexual. Well, admitted might be taking too much credit. For her graduate school project, Mom created undetectable software that helps employers keep track of what their employees are doing. Turns out it's so user-friendly and has such a pretty interface that a consumer version was created and sold to nearly every household with a working computer in the States. I probably should have put 2 and 2 together and realized my parents would also be using it on our home network before I discovered I could stream porn on my phone. That was an awkward conversation, but at least it resulted in a compromise. I could go to certain sites, and they wouldn't stalk me online as long as I didn't lurk on places that, as Mom put it, would give me unrealistic expectations about how sex should be or what our bodies should look like. In the end, my stridently anti-LDS parents moved their emo-scene daughter and queer son back into LDS Wonderland. To compensate for their guilt over making sure I protect myself at all costs, read, be very, very careful about who I come out to, my parents have made our home a gay, gay den of pride. Autumn and I spend most of our time together at her house, and Haley hates almost everyone, and no one from her angry coven ever comes over, so LGBTQ essays, P-flag pamphlets, and rainbow t-shirts are handed to me at spontaneous moments with a kiss and a lingering look of pride. Mom will slide the occasional bumper sticker into my pillowcase to be found when the sharp corner meets my cheek at night. Nothing would be the same if you did not exist. Courage is being yourself every day in a world that tells you to be someone else. Love knows no limits. Normal is just a dial on the washing machine.
Autumn has found a few of them here and there over the years, but shrugs it off with a murmur of, San Francisco, man. It's funny to think about these now in the car, surreptitiously scrolling slack-jawed through photos of Sebastian, because I start imagining them read to me in his deep, gentle voice. Even hearing Sebastian speak a mere 3 times a day, the sound of it still hovers like a drunk honeybee inside my head. Hey, guys. Oh, the book is out in June. I'm here to help, however you need me, so use me. I almost lost it when he said that. A web search doesn't tell me anything I didn't already know. Most of the results for Sebastian's brother are for a steakhouse in Omaha, links to articles about the seminar, or announcements about Sebastian's book. Google Images is where I hit the jackpot. There are photos of him playing baseball and soccer. Yes, I save one. And a few of him doing interviews for local papers. When I click through, his answers don't say much about him. They seem pretty canned. But he's wearing a tie in a lot of the photos, and combined with his hair, I'm ready to start the Sebastian Brothers Spank Bank folder. Really, he's the hottest guy I've ever seen in person. Facebook is a dead end. Sebastian's account is locked, of course it is. So not only can I not see his photos, but I can't see his relationship status either. Not that I care, or will beyond a few days. He's Mormon eye candy. This flash of infatuation won't go anywhere interesting. I wouldn't let it. We're on opposite sides of a very thick fence. I close every window on my phone's browser before I fall prey to the worst social media stalking possible, a futile hunt for his Snapchat or Instagram. Even the idea of stumbling upon a sleepy, shirtless Sebastian selfie wreaks havoc on my nervous system. At the mall, Autumn and I follow my mom as she weaves through the racks of the guys' department at Nordstrom. I'm bored putty in their hands. Mom leads me to a table of shirts, holding a few up to my chest. She narrows her eyes, asks Autumn's opinion, and the two women confer before wordlessly rejecting most of them. I don't comment. I know how this works. My sister is off somewhere getting her own things, giving us a nice reprieve from her constant need to bicker with us. Autumn and Mom get along, and when they're together, I get a break from having to pay attention to anything anyone is saying. They keep each other entertained. Mom holds a hideous Western-themed shirt up to my chest. I can't let this one slide. No. She ignores me and looks to Autumn for her opinion, but Audie is Team Tanner and scrunches her nose in distaste. Hanging the shirt back up, Mom asks her, How is your schedule this term? I love it. Audie hands Mom a short-sleeved blue button-down from RBCA. I give her a covert thumbs up. I may need to switch modern lit to Shakespeare, and calculus is probably going to be my death, but otherwise, good. I'm sure Tanner would love to help you with calc, Mom says, and I feel Autumn roll an eye in my direction. What about you, honey? I lean against the rack, crossing my arms over the silver bar. I added biology after lunch, and now I'm sleepy last period. Mom's blonde hair is smooth and pulled into a ponytail, and she's traded her work clothes for jeans and a sweater. She looks younger dressed like this, and if Haley would drop her Wednesday Addams thing, she and Mom would look like sisters. As if on cue, Haley materializes from behind me, dropping a giant heap of black fabric in Mom's arms. I didn't like any of the pants, but those shirts are cool, she says. Can we eat? I'm starving. Mom looks down at the load in her arms. I can see her mentally counting to 10. As long as I can remember, our parents have encouraged us to be ourselves. When I started questioning my sexuality, they told me their love for me was not dependent on where I stick my dick. Okay, they didn't use those exact words. I just like saying it. Last year, when my sister decided she wanted to start looking like a corpse, they bit their tongues and encouraged her to express herself however she wanted. Our parents are saints when it comes to patience, but I'm getting the sense that this patience is wearing thin. 3 shirts. Mom hands it all back to Haley. I told you 3 shirts, 2 pairs of pants. You already have 12 black shirts. You don't need 12 more. She turns back to me, thwarting Haley's rebuttal. So, biology makes you sleepy. What else? Audie should stick with modern lit. It's going to be an easy A. Oh, our seminar TA is super hot, Autumn tells her. As if moving on some protective instinct, Mom's eyes slide to me and then back to Audie. Who is he? Autumn lets out a distractingly breathy sound. Sebastian Brother. Behind us, my sister groans, and we turn, waiting for the inevitable. His sister Lizzie is in my class. She's always so happy. I scoff at this. Gross, right? Tanner, Mom warns. My sister shoves my shoulder. Shut up, Tanner. Haley. Autumn works to defuse this by redirecting us to the point at hand. Sebastian took the class last year. Apparently his book was really good. Mom hands me a paisley t-shirt that is so hideous I won't acknowledge it. She thrusts it at my chest again, giving me mom face. "Oh, he sold it, right?" she asks Autumn. Autumn nods. "I hope it gets made into a movie and he's in it. He has this floppy soft hair and his smile. God." "He's a splotchy boy blusher," I say before I can think better of it. Beside me, Mom stiffens, but Audie doesn't seem to hear anything odd in what I just said. "He totally is." Mom hangs the shirt back up and laughs tightly. "This one might be a problem." She's looking at Autumn when she says this, but I know without question she's speaking to me. My interest in Sebastian Brothers' visible attributes hasn't diminished by class on Friday. For the first time since I moved here, I'm struggling to fly under the radar. If it were a female TA I was attracted to, it wouldn't be a big deal for someone to occasionally catch me staring. But here, with him, I can't. And the effort it takes to play it cool is frankly exhausting. Fujita and Sebastian make regular rounds of the room while we jot down ideas in any manner that works for us. Outlines, random sentences, song lyrics, drawings, and I'm basically doodling spirals on a blank sheet of paper just to keep from tracking his movement. Beside me, Autumn pounds out what seems like thousands of words per minute on her laptop without coming up for air, and it's distracting and maddening. Irrationally, I feel like she's sucking my creative energy somehow. But when I stand to move to another part of the room for some space, I nearly collide with Sebastian. Chest to chest, we stare at each other for a few seconds before we step back in unison. "Sorry," I say. "No, no, it was me." His voice is both low and quiet, and it has this hypnotic rhythm to it. I wonder whether someday he'll give sermons with that voice, whether he'll throw down judgment with that voice. "Fujita said I should work with you more closely," he says, and I realize now that he was coming over to talk to me. The blush pops in a warm bloom across his face. "He said you seem to, be a little behind on the plotting stage and I should brainstorm with you." Defensiveness and nervous energy creates a strange brew in my veins. We're only 3 class sessions in and I'm already behind, and to hear it from him, this buttoned-up Bible thumper I can't get out of my head, I laugh too loudly. "Yeah, it's okay. Seriously, I'll catch up this weekend. I don't want you to have to take time." "I don't mind, Tanner." He swallows, and I notice for the first time how long his throat is, how smooth. My heart hammers. I don't want to be affected by him. "I need to sort it out in my own head," I say, and then push past him, mortified. I'd expected Sebastian to be a short fascination, a single night of fantasizing, and that's it. But even watching him move through the classroom rocks me. Standing so close to him nearly sent me into a breathless panic. He has command of the space he occupies, but it isn't because he's an imposing jock or somehow bleeding macho into the room. The light just seems to catch his features differently than anyone else around us. Autumn follows me over a few minutes later, putting her hand on my arm. "You okay?" "Absolutely not." "Totally. You don't have to worry about how far ahead everyone else is." I laugh, brought back to the other stress, the novel. "Wow, thanks, Audie." She groans, dropping her head to my arm, laughing now, too. "I didn't mean it like that." When I glance to the side, I see Sebastian just before he looks away from us. Audie stretches, kissing my cheek. "Still up for Manny's birthday party tonight?" "Laser tag to celebrate turning 18. Only in Utah, man." "I don't know. I like Manny, but in all honesty, I'm merely human. I can stomach only so many nights of laser tag." "Come on, Tan. Eric will be there. I need someone to hang with, so I have something to do besides look awkward in front of him." High school is such an incestuous little pool. Autumn has a thing for Eric, who is pining over Rachel, the sister of a girl I kissed after homecoming last year, and who I'm pretty sure dated Haley's best friend's brother. Pick almost anyone here, and it's like 6 degrees of second base. But it's not like there's anything better to do. The sound of music and electronic chimes seeps through the double glass doors outside Fat Cat's. The parking lot is packed. If this were any other town, I might be more surprised. But it's Friday night. Miniature golf, laser tag, and glow-in-the-dark bowling are about as wild as it gets. Autumn is at my side, and the light from her phone illuminates her profile as she does her best to type and walk across the icy sidewalk at the same time. Looping my arm through hers, I guide her around a group of junior high kids with their eyes glued to their own phones and lead us both safely inside.
The year after we moved here, the Scott family drove in Dad's Prius to Vegas for my Aunt Emily's wedding to her girlfriend, Shivani. Haley and I were saucer-eyed the entire weekend. Digital billboards, strip clubs, booze, and bare skin. There was a spectacle everywhere we looked. Here, apart from the obvious differences, like sheer size and the distinct lack of scantily clad cocktail waitresses walking around, there's the same kind of frenzy in the air. Fat Cats is like Vegas for kids and teetotalers. Spiral-eyed patrons slide token after token into blinking machines in the hope of winning something, anything. I spot a bunch of people I know from school. Jack Thorne is playing what I'm sure is a rousing game of skee-ball with a string of tickets slithering along the floor at his feet. Soccer Dave is playing pinball with Clive and has a soccer ball predictably clamped between his feet. The birthday boy himself, our friend Manny Lavia, is goofing off with a few of his brothers near a row of tables in the back, but much to Autumn's chagrin, no Eric in sight. I search the silhouettes in front of the giant movie screens, suspended above the bowling lanes, sorry, Thunder Alley, before giving up. "Are you texting him?" I ask Autumn, looking down to find her still staring intently at her phone. "No." "Then what has you glued to your phone tonight? You've barely come up for air." "I was just typing up a few notes," she says, taking my hand and leading me past the ticket redemption center and toward the tables. "For the book. You know, random thoughts that pop into my head or pieces of dialogue. It's a good way to get stuff down. Fujita is going to expect something on Monday." Stress tightens my gut, and I change the subject. "Come on, Audie. Let me win you something." I win her a gigantic tiger, which I'm guiltily aware will soon become landfill, and we wander back over toward the party room as they're bringing out the food. A haggard woman named Liz tries to bring the party to some sort of order before giving up and dropping a tray of veggies and dip on the center table. Truthfully, we've been here so many times, Liz could go out back and smoke a pack of cigarettes and we'd be fine getting through the night. Eric finds us as Manny's mom is handing out paper plates, and our entire group, about 20 of us in total, moves in a line on either side of the long tables. There's the normal fare of bad pizza and Sprite, but I help myself to some of the dishes his mom has prepared, too. Manny's family is Tongan, and when I first moved here in 10th grade from the diverse wonderland of the South Bay, it was such a relief to find a brown person in the smiling sea of white faces. Because of missionary efforts in Hawaii and other Pacific islands, there's a surprisingly large number of Polynesians in Utah. Manny and his family are no exception, but they're among the LDS families who don't keep only to themselves. Manny is big and hilarious and nearly always smiling. I'd probably be into him if it weren't such an obvious waste of time. He is roaringly heterosexual. I would pull out every penny I have and bet that Manny isn't going to be virginal when he marries. I step up next to Autumn, opening my mouth to tease her about how she's got only a single breadstick on her plate, but the words fall out of my brain. Sebastian Brother is standing across the room, talking to two of Manny's brothers. My pulse takes off in a surging gallop. I didn't know he was going to be here. Audie pulls us over to a bench to sit down and sips a cup of water, distracted. Now that I look closer, I see she's put more effort into how she looks tonight. She straightened her hair. She's wearing sticky, shiny lip gloss. I'm pretty sure her shirt is new. "Why aren't you eating?" I ask, unrolling the paper napkin from the plastic utensils. In an effort to prove she's not looking at Eric, she takes a snap of her food, examines her handiwork, and then types something before turning her phone to face me. It's a photo of her breadstick on a plain white paper plate with the caption, "Dinner," written beneath it. Honestly. "The pizza looked greasy and the other stuff was weird," she says, motioning to my own plate. "That salad thing has raw fish." I look up again and subtly glance over her shoulder to see that Sebastian has moved to the table next to us. There's a backpack on the bench next to him. I'm instantly obsessed with the idea of where he's been. School? The library? Does he live on the BYU campus? Or at home with his parents? I turn back to my food. "It's the same ceviche you had at that place in Park City. You liked it." "I don't remember liking it." Autumn reaches her fork across the table to steal a bite anyway. "By the way, did you see who's here?" As if I could miss him. Eric and Autumn throw out some small talk, and although I'm not really listening, I'm paying enough attention to notice the flashes of awkward every few seconds. Anyone would notice. Autumn's laugh is too loud, the silences stretch and then are broken with a burst of them speaking at the same time. Maybe Eric is into her too, and that explains why they're both acting like a couple of junior high kids. Is it bad that I'm relieved she's into him, even if it could crash and burn, affecting all of us?
My friendship with Audie matters the most to me, and I don't want there to be any residual romantic crumbs between us. If things can go back to normal for good, maybe I can eventually tell her everything. Maybe I'll have someone to talk to about this Sebastian dilemma. And with that, the cat ears of my thoughts have turned back around, focusing behind me. It's like Sebastian's mere presence hums. I want to know where he is every second. I want him to notice me. This plan is prematurely thwarted when Manny drags a bunch of us to the laser tag arena. I go begrudgingly, following them into the briefing room where we await our instructions. Autumn has opted to watch from the observation area in the next room, so I stand with Eric, wondering if there's a way for me to slip out unnoticed before the game starts. But when I move toward the doorway, I see Sebastian and Manny's brother Cole step into the arena. I nearly choke on my gum. I'm not even pretending to listen when the instructor comes in. I'm unable to drag my eyes away from Sebastian and the way his jaw and his face and his hair look in this light. He must be having a hard time paying attention as well, because his gaze flickers away to scan the room, and he sees me for 1, 2, 3 seconds. He stares back. Recognition flashes across his face, and when he smiles, my stomach lurches like the floor has dropped out from under my feet. Help me. I smile back, a wobbly mess. My name is Tony, and I'm your game master, the instructor says. I blink away, forcing myself to turn toward the front. Have we chosen the two team captains? When nobody volunteers, he points to where Sebastian and Cole are standing on the periphery and gestures for us to follow him to the vesting room. Somehow in the shuffle, Eric winds up at the end of the line, and I'm right next to Sebastian. May God bless Eric. On each side of the room, there are rows of vests outfitted with power packs. Tony instructs us to slip one on and secure it in the front, miming the action like a flight attendant readying us for takeoff. Remove the phaser from the charging station and pull the trigger, he says. You'll see a code name appear on the LED screen. Everyone see theirs? I do as he says, and the name, The Patriot, flashes across the small screen. A covert check of Sebastian's shows the name Sergeant Blue. Remember that name. It's how your score will be posted on the boards outside after the game. To score points and win, you have to take out your opponents on the other team. You can do this in one of six places. Tony reaches for Manny's sleeve and pulls him to his side. Here's where you should aim, he says, dramatically pointing a finger to each of the illuminated packs attached to the vest. If you're hit in the shoulder or back, your vest will flash, and the hit will be counted. Get hit in the chest, and your vest will flash, but your phaser will also lock. You can still be hit, but you won't be able to fire back. You'll be a sitting duck until you get to your base, or find a place to hide until your gun powers up again. He lets go of Manny and looks around the room. There will be two teams playing in the arena, and each team's vest will be lit with that team's specific color. Pointing to Cole's vest, he says, Team Red, and then he points to Sebastian's. Team Blue, shoot at any color that isn't your own. Each team's base corresponds to your color, and you get triple points for hitting and destroying your opponents. Beside me, Sebastian shifts, and I see him look briefly my way, his eyes dropping down to my feet and back up. Goosebumps erupt across my skin. Now before we begin the battle, Tony says, a few rules. No running, you will run into someone or something. No lying down on the ground, you will be stepped on. No physical contact of any kind, and that includes making out in the dark. We can see you. I cough, and Sebastian shifts at my side. Tony finishes up, warning us against beating each other with our weapons, or, God forbid, profanity, and it's time to start. It was dim in the vesting room, but it still takes a moment for my eyes to adjust to the darkness of the arena. Our teams spread out among walls that look like neon brick, and I spot our base in the center. Black lights illuminate the glowing set pieces, but it's hard to make out much else. The sound of phasers powering up one by one moves like a wave across the arena, and a countdown begins overhead. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Sirens pierce the air. I race around one wall and then another. It's so dark I can barely see, but the partitions and perimeter of the room are marked with textured neon paint or strips of colored light. A green tank seems to glow in the corner, and I see a flash of red, a rush of movement in front of it. I fire off a shot, and the vest pulses red, registering the hit. My own vest flashes when I'm hit, rounding a corner. Target hit, my gun says, but it must have been in the shoulder because when someone dodges in front of a wall, I'm still able to fire, blasting their chest sensor and ensuring their gun is useless.
Two other players come from opposite sides, and I turn and run, racing toward the base. It's hot in here, with absolutely no air movement. Sweat rolls down the back of my neck. My pulse is frantic. Music and sound effects throb overhead, and if I close my eyes, it would be easy enough to pretend we're all in a rave, instead of rushing around a dark room shooting at each other with plastic laser guns. I take out two more players, and manage a series of rapid-fire hits on the red team's base when I'm hit again, this time in the back. Retracing my steps the way I came, I run into Eric. "There's a couple of them near the tank," he says. "They're just sitting there waiting for people to rush by." I nod, able to make him out only by the white of his t-shirt and the packs on his vest. "I'll go around," I yell above the music. "Try to get them from behind." Eric pats my shoulder and I race around the partition. The arena is a two-tiered maze with ramps you can jump on to avoid fire or climb up to get a better shot. "Target hit, target hit, target hit," my gun registers and my vest lights up. Footsteps race behind me. When I lift my gun to fire back, there's nothing. I've been hit in the chest. I look around, searching for my team's base or somewhere to hide, when I feel a body crash into mine, whoever it is pulling me into a small corner just as Cole and one of his teammates run by. "Holy, thank you," I say, wiping my arm across my forehead. "No problem." My pulse trips. I'd almost forgotten Sebastian was here. He exhales out of breath, and a shiver of heat makes his way up my spine. It's too loud to talk, and we're too close for me to turn and look at him without it being weird, too intimate, so I stand still while my brain goes haywire. He's holding my vest, my back is pressed tight to his front. It's less than 10 seconds, the time it takes for my gun to unlock, but I swear I feel every tick of the clock. My breath sounds loud in my ears. I can feel my pulse, even above the music. I can feel Sebastian's breath, too, hot against my ear. My fingers itch to reach back and touch the side of his face, to feel whether he's blushing, here in the dark. I want to stay in this dark corner forever, but I feel the moment my gun powers up in my hand. He doesn't wait, gripping the side of my vest before pushing me out and shouting at me to follow, toward the red base. Eric rounds the corner, and we sprint across the floor and around the partition. "Go, go!" Sebastian shouts, and we fire in unison. It only takes a few blasts before the base flashes red, and a recorded voice sounds overhead. "Red base destroyed. Game over." Chapter 4. For the first time in my high school career, I don't need my schedule taped to my locker with dino stickers to know where I'm supposed to be. Our first week back, Fujita's seminar is on Monday, Wednesday, Friday. This week, it's Tuesday and Thursday. It alternates pretty steadily until the end of the year. I can see three ways this could go. One, I could love MWF weeks because there are three chances to see Sebastian. Two, I could loathe MWF weeks because there are three chances to see Sebastian, but he only attends one class regardless. Three, I could loathe MWF weeks because there are three chances to see Sebastian, and he's there all the time, but doesn't show me the time of day. In this last scenario, I grow resentful that I can't seem to shake this crush on an LDS diehard, drown myself in cheese fries and fry sauce, grow a gut, do a crappy job in the class, and lose my admission to the out-of-state school of my dreams. "What are you thinking?" Autumn appears behind me, tucking her chin over my shoulder. "Nothing." I slam my locker shut, zipping up my backpack. In reality, I'm thinking that it isn't fair to think of Sebastian as an LDS diehard. I don't know how to explain it, but he seems so much more than that. She growls in mild irritation and turns to head down the hall toward the seminar. I catch up and dodge a group of juniors having a piggyback race down the hall. I've been trained well by her and bounce the question back. "What are you thinking?" If nothing else, her elaborate answer will keep me distracted from my own spiral into madness. Autumn hooks her arm through mine. "I'm wondering how your outline is coming." "Ah, right, my outline. The skeletal document with proverbial tumbleweeds blowing across the tundra. It's fine." "One, two, three. Want me to take a peek before we go in?" I grin. "No, Adi, I'm good." She stops right at the entrance to class. "Did you finish it?" "Finish what?" From the flare of her nostrils, I know my best friend is imagining me dead and bloody on the floor. "The outline." A mental image pops into my head of the Word doc with two lonely lines I wouldn't dare show a soul. A half-Jewish, half-nothing queer kid moves to an LDS-infested town. He can't wait to leave. "No."
Do you think you should? I offer her a single arched eyebrow in response. This is only our fourth class, and despite the hallowed reputation of this room, already we seem to have a rhythm, a certain comfort being hooligans until Fujita shows up. Soccer Dave, with his ever-present soccer ball, starts kicking it with alternating feet, while Burrito Dave counts out the number of times he does it without letting it hit the floor. Julie and McKenna are loud.